So that's what I'm going to tell you about in the next 20 minutes, how to rule out cold dark matter, no ifs and buts, without any exceptions. So the Lambda CDM model of cosmology was dates back, as we all know, to the 1980s. In fact, I think one could say it was born here in this place, in a workshop similar to this, but much smaller, in 1984, where the first papers on Lambda CDM were written. And that model made testable predictions, which were subsequently verified by data that followed 20 years later, like the microwave background fluctuations and galaxy clustering. So here is a summary of 30 years of progress in cosmology. So what's plotted here is the power spectrum of density perturbations. And here in red are the measurements from the microwave background, temperature and isotropies extrapolated to redshift zero using linear theory, where you can compare them with the measures of the same quantity from galaxy clustering. And the black line here are the predictions from Lambda CDM. So this is really stunning success in the subject, but there's here an if and a but. This success tells us nothing about Lambda, no idea what that is. And also, it doesn't tell us that the dark matter is CDM. For example, if the dark matter was something else, say a warm particle like a sterile neutrino, then that would impose a cutoff in the power spectrum, but we would be none the wiser with the data that we have, because these warm dark matter models would predict exactly the same large-scale structure and microwave background fluctuations as CDM. Now, the cutoff here in the power spectrum happens to scale roughly inversely with the mass of the particle. So basically, both CDM and warm dark matter are compatible with everything we know about large-scale structure. And as many of you will know, there are claims that both types of dark matter have already been discovered. CDM from the so-called gamma ray excess measured by Fermi towards the center of the Milky Way, which can be interpreted as annihilation radiation from cold dark matter. And equally, there's a 3.5 keV X-ray line seen in galaxies and clusters that could be interpreted as well as the decay of a 7 keV sterile neutrino. It seems to me very, very unlikely that both these claims are right. I think most of you would think it's very unlikely that any of the two is correct. Nevertheless, while the physicists get their act together, in fact, it turns out that from astrophysics, we can make a lot of progress in ruling these various possibilities out. And that is because for interesting warm particles, the cutoff in the power spectrum occurs on the scale of dwarf galaxies. And so by studying dwarf galaxies, we can hope to make some progress in understanding what the nature of the dark matter is. So let me show you a movie that shows how the halo of the Milky Way would form. On the left, in the case of cold dark matter, on the right, in the case of warm dark matter. And here you see in CDM, structure begins to form at redshift 20 or so. There's already quite a lot of lumps. Nothing's happened here in warm dark matter because of the cutoff in the power spectrum. Eventually, at redshift 10 or so, the first structures begin to collapse. The phases of the two simulations are the same. This blobs that one. That one is that one. So on the large, the sort of Milky Way halo, things are on that scale the same in the two cases. But of course, on small scales, they're very different because of this cutoff. And here's another movie made by Mike Lobel, my former student, which really shows you how different the universe or the Milky Way would look like if we live in a universe made of cold dark matter as opposed to one made of warm dark matter. So how do we distinguish between these two? Now, luckily, this is a theoretical institute. Nevertheless, there are a few observers around here, and I think observers should be extremely embarrassed that they spend billions of dollars building instruments and satellites and so on, and they cannot tell us where we live in a place like this or in a place like that. Now, I'll tell you why they shouldn't be embarrassed in a minute, but the obvious test would be to say, well, just count how many lumps you have. Count the satellites of the Milky Way. We know the Milky Way has about 50 satellites. So let's count, and well, we can count hundreds of thousands here. Here, you start counting with 1, 2, 3, 4, there's like about 50. So you'd say, well, game over. We know that we live in a universe made of sterile neutrinos. Well, of course, that argument is completely wrong, and we haven't just known that recently. We've known that for a long time. And that is because most of these halos that you see here in a CDM model never managed to make a visible galaxy for very simple physics. It's very robust, well understood physics. One of the processes, there are two that are important. One is we know the universe was reionized, emerging out from the Big Bang. If you reionize hydrogen, it's heated to a temperature of 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And that just means that the gas will never be able to cool and form stars in halos whose virial temperature is less than the equivalent of this temperature. The entropy of the gas is just too high. And then for slightly larger halos that do make a few stars, all it takes is one supernova to completely eject the gas out of the halo, and you end up with a essentially dark halo with just one stellar remnant. So that's been known for a long time, and it was first really calculated in detail by Andrew Benson, who's sitting over there. He has worked from his thesis in 2002, and what he showed using a semianalytic model is he calculated these physical processes, and he then obtained the predictions for the satellite luminosity function compared to what was known in 2002. Rachel was emphasizing the need to have predictions. Well, there is a prediction here, namely Andrew predicted that should be a large population of very faint satellites that was not known in 2002. There's another prediction, Marla. Look at the huge scatter here at the magnitude that you're probing. But the main prediction was there should be a population of ultra-faint satellites, and that was duly discovered in Sloan several years later. Now, this doesn't mean to say that CDM is the right theory, maybe, but it does tell us that at least we understand some of the physics of galaxy formation quite well. Now, this result has now been confirmed many times over. We're now using hydro simulations. We've heard a lot about the Eagle project. The reason you should take these ones quite seriously is because we're using the same code in the zooms that I'm going to tell you about in a minute that we use for the Eagle large volume simulations, which means that we know that this code produces the observed stellar mass function, which I think is an important constraint to have some reliability in the predictions that one makes. So as part of Eagle, we carried out the Apostle project, which is the resimulations of a large number of local groups. That's a work being led by Till Zavala. And here is one such local group. Here's the Milky Way, here's M31, as you would see them if you were able to see the dark matter. Of course, we don't see the dark matter. We see the stars, and the universe looks certainly a lot more interesting in dark matter than it does in stars. And you can see most of these halos, just as we advertised, never made a galaxy. Some did. This big one made a galaxy and a few others. But most of these halos, just as Andrew told us, and other people, Rachel, and Bullock and others never managed to make a galaxy. So here are the predicted satellite luminosity functions. Here's, for example, the number of dark halos, many, many more than galaxies, that satellites of the Milky Way. Here for the Milky Way, these are the observations. Here are the predictions. Again, please notice the high, large scatter here. Here is for M31, and here is for the local volume. And these results have now been confirmed. You just heard that fire subsequently got the same answer. And here's another completely different code. This is a repo as part of a project called Auriga, led by Volker Springel and Rudiger Packmore, Marinacci, and others. And here, again, one can compute the luminosity function of satellites, and the answer is exactly the same. So it doesn't really depend on the code, but these are results that were already known a long time ago, just using simple physics, because the physics here are simple. Now, so something that's less well established and maybe more depending on the code, here's a plot I like a lot to place myself in the universe, which shows you the key axis is here, the fraction of dark matter halos that are dark. So let's look at the blue line here, which is for centrals. And according to the simulations, and this we disagree possibly a little bit with fire, but according to this, all satellites with, or all halos, sorry, centrals with mass less than 5 × 10⁸ are dark. 100% of them are dark. Then there's a very sharp fall off, and then everything brighter than about, sorry, more massive, halos more massive than 10⁻⁰ manage to make a galaxy. So the details here, I'm sure, we can argue about, but I think the general behavior is probably quite correct, and it has implications, particularly for the kind of things that people have been talking about here, because it tells you that abundance matching won't work, and these masses here is a plot with no simulations, it's actual data showing stellar mass, halo mass, and Here's an extrapolation of Ben Moster's abundance matching. It clearly fails. You can see here that most of these satellites around these masses, stellar masses, all live more or less in the same halo. And that's just because we're in the region where only a fraction of the satellites are occupied. Here is a plot now from Apostle. I think Alison talked about it later. She said we didn't distinguish between centrals and satellites. We did, but it's probably invisible because the centrals are the open circles and the satellites are the filled circles, and even I cannot distinguish them from here. But nevertheless, here you can see that the simulations do agree with the data, but in particular, you must never use abundance matching below halo masses of 10 to the 10, unless you read the paper and adopt a correction that we made in this paper. Tells you how you can correct abundance matching if you wanted to use it. It's all in this paper called Bent Bivariance. Now, so about warm dark matter. So interestingly, I keep saying it when I talk, many of you will have heard me say this, how I become apoplectic when I hear people talk about the satellite problem in CDM. Problem was solved 15 years ago. So please never use it again unless you're talking about warm dark matter, because warm dark matter does have a satellite problem, but it's the opposite. As I said, the cut of wavelength depends inversely on the mass of the particle. So if the mass of the particle is too small, then there are not enough satellites even to make, enough subhalos even to make 50 satellites. So in fact, it turns out that one can, I'm not gonna go into details, you can read a paper by Mike Global, that one can actually already rule out quite a lot of parameter space of the 7 keV stellar neutrino, the one that supposedly has been detected, just because the models do not produce enough satellites to match the ones that we see in the Milky Way and M31. So that's that for the satellite problem. Let me just summarize. The observed abundance of satellites is compatible with CDM, but can be actually used to rule out some warm dark matter models. Now, so we can distinguish CDM from warm dark matter by counting satellites. And what are we gonna do? Now, there's no need to despair, and I'm going to go back to the title of my talk and tell you how, in fact, we can rule out many of these possibilities in a very conclusive way. Now, it's obvious when you look at this that we've been going about it the wrong way. You don't want to count the visible things. That's complicated. We want to count the dark things, and that is much simpler, and actually it turns out that this can be done. So the key to what I'm going to tell you from now on is don't look at what you can see with the telescope. Try to infer something about what you cannot see with the telescope. Now, so just to place ourselves in the right context, here's the mass function of halos going all the way to 10 to the 6 solar masses for CDM, and this is for turns out to be the coldest 7 keV stellar neutrino. If you rule this one out, you rule out all the 7 keV stellar neutrinos. And you can see because of that cutoff in the power spectrum, the number begins to fall below CDM, and by about 10 to the 8 solar masses or so, the numbers are down by a factor of 10, and it just plummets below that. So that's a very clear-cut prediction, a big difference between the two, which you can just see by eye here. Now, it turns out that there are ways to count dark substructures or structures. One is through gaps. We already heard about this. from Garrison Kimmel told us about Shea, told us about to mention gaps in stellar streams. He was a bit pessimistic about the possibility of detecting those. I am less pessimistic, but the idea is when a gap, when a stream, a tidal stream, in particular a cold tidal stream, like from a globular cluster, crosses one of these substructures, then that produces a gap. And I don't know whether this will work or not. It's still early days, but I do know that the other method will work, and that is gravitational lensing. And that is, I think, a very powerful technique to count these dark things. There's a particular form of gravitational lensing that I'm interested in, and that is the following. If you have a source that's perfectly well aligned with a lens, then if the alignment is perfect, then you get this amazing phenomena that nature has produced, these Einstein rings, which is just what happens due to lensing when you have very good alignment between the source and the lens. So that we understand. But of course, it's not just the lens, the main lens that can lens the light from the source. Structures along the line of sight and substructures also lens. And the result of that is that they produce distortions in the Einstein rings. So the Einstein rings are distorted because the light is deflected not just by the main lens, but also by either substructures in the lens or any structure along the line of sight. And that detecting the substructure is something that Simona Vegetti and Ion Koopmans have pioneered, and they have already found a dark substructure with a mass of 10 to the 8 solar masses. You need to do quite a lot of complicated modeling, but they know how to do this. And the main thing is they claim they can detect halos or subhalos as small as 10 to the 7 solar masses. So that is just what we need. If you remember the plot I show you, the abundance of halos or subhalos in warm dark matter just plummets below 10 to the 8. So if warm dark matter is right, then we should find no 10 to the 7 solar mass halos. Zero. If warm dark matter is right, if CDN is right, we should find lots of 10 to the 7 solar mass halos. If you don't find any, that's curtains for CDN. Okay? So that's the key thing. Now, so let me now tell you a little bit about the detail. Of course, there are complications. And firstly, as we heard from Andrew Wetzel and also from Shea, the central galaxy can destroy subhalos. That's one thing. And the other important consideration is which dominates the signal, the subhalos in the lens or halos along the line of sight. And I'm going to tell you the answer to these two. The first one you can see in two papers, one by Till Savala et al. And one by Jack Richings, which will be posted very soon. I'll tell you first about that, and then I'll tell you about the other one. Now, we've already seen these from Shea, Garrison, Kimmel, and I don't know whether we agree or not. Our paper came out first, so I'm still waiting for Shea to tell me whether he agrees or not, but I think we do. Here you see a picture of a dark matter-only simulation. You see many more structures near the center than you see in the Apostle simulation. And what we find, I think it's consistent with Shea, he can tell us, but we find that there is, in fact, if you look in the central parts, here is between 0 and 10 kiloparsecs, which is actually where the Einstein ring is. This is the key part for lensing. We find projected between 0 and 10 kiloparsecs that the number of substructures that get killed off by interaction with the disk is about 50%. So 60% of the substructures survive. If you look further out, more of them survive. So we understand that. I think we can argue about it. Whether we get the same numbers or not, but that argument would be moot. It's a pointless argument, because I'm about to show you that it doesn't really matter, because the ones that dominate are not the signal, are not the subhalos, which may be subject to baryon effects. They are the ones along the line of sight, which have never seen a baryon in their life. So this is work by Ran Lee and Sean Cole and myself and others, and what you see here is the surface brightness, which is what's surface mass density, which is what's relevant for lensing as a function of the mass of the halo subhalo. And these are this is the signal, the lensing signal you expect from the projected halos along the line of sight. It's about a factor of 10 bigger than what you get from subhalos. So even if we don't understand subhalos well because of these baryon effects, we don't particularly care, because the only ones we're looking for are the ones that are projected along the line of sight, and these have never seen a baryon in their life. So it's a very, very clean test. The difference is slightly smaller for warm dark matter. And so the answer to these two considerations is, firstly, the central galaxy destroys about 40% of halos within the Einstein ring, fine. But projected halos, not subhalos, dominate the signal. So we don't even need to worry about getting these right. We need to worry about actually measuring the lensing and interpreting it correctly. So here is my next to last slide, which shows you how the test will work. So what's plotted here on the y-axis is the projected halo number density within the Einstein ring of a 10 to the 13 solar mass halo, which is what's optimal for this test. Let's assume Simona is right, and there's a detection limit of 10 to the 7. And what's plotted on the x-axis here is this cutoff wavelength, which of this cutoff mass, which we know is about 10 to the 8 solar masses for the coldest 7 keV stellar neutrino, shown here by red. So let's suppose that we live in a warm dark matter universe. We live here. Then with 100 lenses, you could, that's the results that you would get. So it's 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours in constraining these two parameters. Obviously, this is a relevant one. So if with 100 lenses, we would know that this cutoff is 10 to the 8, if we live in a universe like that, and the 3 sigma contour would be several times 10 to the 7. So we would rule out CDM completely at a very, very high significance, because of course CDM doesn't have a cutoff. Well, it has a cutoff at an Earth mass, so it's not relevant here. So if we live in a universe made of warm dark matter with 100 lenses, then we would rule out CDM. And if we live in a CDM universe with 100 lenses and this detection limit, here are the contours that we would find for this quantity. So we would rule out the coldest stellar neutrino, again, by many sigma. So I think this test is super neat. I'll urge everybody to drop everything you're doing and go work on the subject, because this is how we will, in fact, come to rule out all these possibilities, possibly even dark matter. I know I'm going backwards here, but anyway. So let me conclude. Lambda CDM is a great success on large scales, as evidenced by the microwave background, temperature and isotropies, and large scale structure and galaxy evolution. But on these scales, we cannot distinguish lambda CDM from, for example, a universe made of stellar neutrinos, which of course makes a big difference to particle physicists. But on small scales, the identity of the dark matter makes a very big difference. And counting galaxies that you can see will not distinguish these two models. I also mentioned, because it's a topic that's been recurring at this meeting, that halos about less than 5 times 10 to the 8 are dark. So halos are dark, and bigger than 10 to the 10 tend to be bright. These numbers could change depending on the subgrid physics, but they would be roughly there. And the main point I made is that strong gravitational lensing distortions of Einstein rings will distinguish between CDM and warm dark matter once we have 100 lenses, and I should tell you they already exist. And in principle, we could finally do what I set out to do with Simon here in 1984, rule out CDM. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos.
Yeah, Simon Beer. So I work in this field for most of my time.
Do you know the answer already?
We can rule out 2 keV at the moment. But what I want to point out is the mass definition.
Yes.
When you talk Simona Vigetti's definition in lensing, I think we have to be aware it's about an order of magnitude difference than what most people talk here in the room when they say a halo mass. So it's more like 10 to the 9 and above, depends on the limit.
Look, I think the point you make is actually very important. We're about to launch an initiative. Simon and I are joining up to make a very large number of artificial lensing maps where you'll be mock catalogs with Einstein rings and distortions and so on. And we will invite people who work in the subject to, without knowing what's in there, only Simon and I will know what's in them, to do a blind test and see, firstly, whether the pipelines recover some structures, and most importantly, what does the recovery actually mean? I agree with you that the people who've done this work so far assume a particular model for the density distribution in the halo, which is not what the simulations would indicate, but these are all problems that we can iron out. So I don't think the question is whether the sensitivity is there to see the 10 to the 8, 10 to the 7 solar mass halos. And we have to wait and see. But I hope that, I mean, and you know, these things get better and better with lenses, with Almonds on. I think the sensitivity can be brought down. Yes.
Alexi? Carlos, you showed that plot that projection effects are important. I just wanted to ask for your thoughts about, doesn't that make the interpretation of the subhalo masses more complicated? And what's your plan?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Oh, you said that in terms of the strong lensing, the projection effects are important.
Yeah, it's the line of sight
objects. That's right, yeah.
Projected along the line of sight.
Doesn't that make the subhalo masses more difficult to constrain?
Yeah,
what's your plan?
That's a good point.
What's your plan?
There is a degeneracy between the mass and the redshift, right? So you don't know whether you see a big distortion because you have a very big a very big halo in the right place, or whether it's small subhalo at a different, or small halo, sorry, at a different redshift. So this is a degeneracy, and we suggest how you can break that degeneracy in this paper by run. So I think with enough measurements, one can actually break the degeneracy, because we know in a particular model, say CDM, we can predict exactly what the halo mass function is and how it changes with redshift.
Carlos. So with respect to talking about looking at faint galaxies versus dark halos, just two comments. One is, cannot distinguish CDM versus warm dark matter, okay, but there are other variants to cold dark matter, self-interaction, where I think it remains perfectly valid to think about how we can use luminous local dwarf galaxies as probes of dark matter structure.
I agree with that. And even in the case of warm dark matter, let alone self-interacting dark matter, you can already, as we have done, rule out parts of parameter space. I think that's right. So I think my statement, I don't want to imply that there's no point going to look at satellites. I mean, poor Marla, she spent 5 years doing this. So and I think we learn a lot. Now we learn a lot, not just, but first of all, we learn a lot about galaxy formation, which is crucial. We will learn something about the nature of the dark matter as well. But really what I'm after is ruling out CDM. And I think in that, well, the simplest version of CDM. If it is self-interacting, I mean, the thing is, most models that I know about that are not standard CDM have a cutoff in the power spectrum, because they were all incorrectly motivated by trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist, which is the satellites problem. So the particle physicists don't pay attention to what we say, and they come up with models that all have a cutoff, trying to reduce the number of satellites of the Milky Way, when we don't really need to do that because astrophysics does it. So I think many of the self-interacting dark matter models also have a cutoff. All that class of models could in principle be ruled out by these tests.
And I just want to add one other thing, is I think we also need to be careful. I mean, you talk about detecting dark halos, but I'm not at all confident that even with the lensing systems, we can actually talk about that they're truly dark systems that will have good enough photometric imaging to say these have no stars in them.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I agree it doesn't matter for the total mass, but I'm saying we shouldn't try to sell it as detecting completely dark structures, because I don't think we'll ever actually be able to make that claim. I agree, but I say we shouldn't talk about detecting completely dark structures, because I don't think we can actually make that claim.
But Andrew, I know you and I have disputed this number, argued about it. I know it was you with somebody. But it'll be something like this.
But that'll be a model-dependent statement. Sure. It won't actually be observation.
Yeah. No, I agree. But as Simon points out, it doesn't really matter.
Carlos.
Yeah.
In large-scale structure, we usually think of small scales, nonlinear scales are hard, linear scales are easy. So when you look at this cutoff at high K, what do? You go to higher redshift where things are linear. And do we have that kind of probe? Yes, it's called Lyman of the Forest.
Yeah.
And it rules out all of these models that you're talking about in the linear regime.
No, actually, so Juris, not quite. So first of all, I agree it's linear, it's easier. I'm a great fan of the Lyman alpha forest and Matteo Ville's results. But first of all, could be gas dynamics complications. But at any rate, let's take the results at face value. It rules out some of these models, but it doesn't rule out the coldest 7 keV stellar neutrino. So that, is not ruled out. It's perfectly compatible. And you know, there's this whole story about the thermal history of the intergalactic medium that we don't really quite understand its temperature evolution, which could make a big difference to the theoretical prediction. So, yes, I agree with you, but it won't rule out CDM. It may rule out some of the alternatives. Now, so this is this gets complicated, because depends how you convert the wavelength. The stellar neutrino it's a two-parameter family for the point of view of large-scale structure. You could see briefly in one of my plots, there was something called L6, which is the baryon asymmetry parameter, and the power spectra can change quite a lot for a fixed neutrino, for a fixed stellar neutrino mass. So I can tell you, because I checked, that Matteo Ville's results do not rule out a large part of the parameter space. It more or less rules out the same as we were able to rule out by, as Andrew correctly points out, looking at the satellites of the Milky Way. I think the two are complementary.
About the question about which of the effects is more important, the satellites or the line of sight substructure, line of sight halos, My question is whether this is a mass-dependent statement, like you did this for 10 to the 7, or it also holds for a few times 10 to the 8?
No, the plot I show you, just here. I don't know why I have this twice. Anyway. So this plot is a function of mass.
Okay.
So the difference between them, for CDM actually, the difference is more or less constant.
Yeah.
It's a log plot, so it's the same factor of 10. For Wondak Mare, it's just a factor of 2 here.
Right.
But it grows.
So yes. The fact that there was this 10 to the 8 kind of object which was observed by Simona and Leon, they claim that that's a satellite. But your prediction would be that most likely it's something along the line of sight?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, he made a very important point. The 10 to the 8 is she has a particular model, which means one thing by mass, which is not the same as what you need.
Sure. Yeah, I understand. But that was interpreted as a satellite.
I would say, there's 3 times more likely that she's seen something along the line of sight, then it's okay, whatever.
I think the structural parameters of that object were such that it was less likely anyway that it was a satellite rather than.
Right. Yeah, because it was too big. You mean too close? Yeah. I think that's right.
I want to come back to Alexei's point because I think it confuses things. The fact that things can be substructures in the lens, or things along the line of sight, doesn't confuse things, it actually makes the test much more robust. Because as we've seen, we can argue quite a lot about substructures inside halos. But I don't think there's any real disagreement in the community at all about, in these models, what the number of independent halos in the field is at these mass ranges at each redshift. And you know that abundance at every redshift along the line of sight, so you can just do the integral along the line of sight compared with the signal, and that's much more robust than trying to do things with SERPs. So, and that predicts, Carlos would say, the dominant effect, at least a large fraction. So that is an irreducible effect. If cold dark matter is right, that effect has to be there independent of anything that's going on with the substructures in the lens. And if you don't find it, you've excluded the model.
That's why I say no ifs and buts. You know, if you don't find these things, and you convince the world that you didn't find them because it's a null test, right? You have to convince the world that I looked for something and I didn't find it, therefore the standard model of cosmological dark matter is ruled out. I think it'll be a high barrier, but that's why there's no ifs and buts. I mean, this is a very clean-cut, unambiguous test. I completely agree with Simon. There's this issue of the mass redshift degeneracy, but we can solve that, so yes.
Let's thank Carlos again.